WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this Halloween edition of the Sunday Spin for October 30th, 2016. This is our weekly look at politics as we count down these final days until the November 8th election. So time to grab the Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best, as always, to try to get your week off to a good start. But we do have the results of last night's baseball game. And we need to get the week off to a good start. We need a victory tonight because, and Sam, I hadn't even really thought of it that way, but you're right. This is the last game of the season of the year at Wrigley Field.
That's it.
Wow. You know, I've talked about this in the past, and I've only been to one postseason game, and that was that ill-fated Marlins series. But when you look at that center field scoreboard, and you see just two teams on that scoreboard, and you see the two flags of the last two teams remaining, that's just, I mean, that's just like a goosebump sight, you know? And despite the fact we're down, but we're not out, and we've seen 3-1 comebacks before.
The last one was 1985, Kansas City Royals.
Well, that's baseball.
It was the Royals. What about Boston?
They were down 3-0.
3-0. Okay, and then came back. Yeah.
That was in the American League Championship Series, though. That
wasn't. That was not the World Series. Okay.
That was against the Yankees in 2004.
Okay.
But we've seen the Blackhawks down in playoffs 3-1 before.
Oh, now we're comparing baseball to hockey.
No, I'm just talking about. I'm comparing seven game series is what I'm comparing.
I know.
I'm not going to go the apples to oranges route here. You can hear plenty of that when we start talking about the politics.
I know. Swanee's going to start comparing kiwis to bananas.
All right, go ahead, Swanee.
I was going to suggest pomegranates, but.
You do have, Rick, John Lester, Jake Arrieta, Kyle Hendricks. So if you need a little boost of optimism, you have three pitchers in the game for games 5, 6, and 7. You just have to win tonight, and then the pressure goes back on Cleveland.
And I have to tell it's not the pitching as much. I'm worried about our bats.
That would help, too, if you could score.
I mean, this is, as we saw with the Dodgers series, you know, the bats went a little cold and then came back in a big way. And, boy, they need to come back in a big way tonight. They just, I mean, I'm not going to state the obvious, but the bats just have to come back tonight. And I thought it actually, you know, the way the game started last night, getting a run off Kluber early, I thought, you know, this could be a good night.
Try this one on. One win in the World Series, the Cubs have 5 runs.
Yeah.
In the 3 losses, they have a combined 2 runs.
Ouch.
So it's boom or bust.
Yeah. Well, and one thing, and I'd be curious about your thoughts on this. One thing I've been curious about. Now, you know, obviously big bats, extra base hits, that kind of thing. But I almost wondered at times if they shouldn't, you know, try to play small ball. And just the old Cardinals, Whitey Herzog, Whitey ball kind of thing, and take advantage of the youthful legs and play small ball.
I couldn't believe that 1-0 game, not last night, the night before when the wind was blowing out. I felt like Baez, Contreras, a lot of those younger right-handed hitters were trying to hit the ball to Evanston.
Right.
Does that make sense? Now,
well, just because they were swinging so hard?
I mean, the wind blowing out, you see the flags bustling, and you think home runs, and you think, you know, deep drives are going to go over. And I think just over-aggressiveness kind of let them down a lot. And then the strike zone last night got even bigger. I mean, they were just chasing, but Kluber was throwing curveballs. They were bouncing in front of the plate, and these guys were trying to golf them over the wall. And, you know, it's hard to change your game plan when it's worked all season long to 103 wins, it's hard to change things in the very last round. I know what you're saying, but, I mean, you can't teach a dog new tricks in the World Series.
No, I know. But it, and I have to tell you, too, that that prospect of the wind blowing out like it was, I had to wonder if this was going to be one of those, you know, 24-20, 11 inning games or something going into that, because the way the flags were pointing straight out to left field, left center, and nothing to show for it. It's very, very frustrating. I mean, it's our ballpark. We know how to play there, and obviously we know how to win there.
Got silent last night too, quite a bit. I don't know how much fans play into it. I'm not a big believer that fans will affect the outcome of the game, but there are times in the fourth or fifth inning when you could hear a pin drop in there.
Which is amazing. I mean, that's...
It's like the doubt creeps in, right? And fans are like, uh-oh, here it is. Here's the right hook to the jaw.
Well, let's face it, it is our second nature, being Cub fans, that there's always the lingering doubt.
Yeah, and they were showing some very solemn faces.
Well,
close-ups.
And even when we were down 4-1, I thought, you know, hey, we're still in this game. But that home run was just a killer.
And that was it, yeah.
And that was the saddest seventh-inning stretch I've ever been a part of. Because Kipnis hits the home run in the top of the seventh to put him up 7-1. And they're like, all right, Vince Vaughn, seventh-inning stretch.
Yeah.
Like, oh.
Hard act to follow, yeah.
A Disney sing-along after 7-1.
Well, as I said, it takes four games to win the series. We've got a rough road ahead of us. But, hey.
It can happen.
It can happen. And what is it? Is the old cliche from...
Yogi Berra?
No.
It's not over till it's over?
There's that. And you got to play them one game at a time, right?
Yeah.
Which is... Part of the cliches was the reason that I switched from being a sports writer to a political writer.
The cream will rise to the top.
Right. The good Lord willing, there'll be another day for baseball. But let's do it tonight, guys. We've been counting on you all year. You've delivered. Let's do it. Let's do it tonight. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Sam's here with the latest sports. We've got producer Lee substituting for a birthdaying producer, Jasmine. She's here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that very same number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, all together one word. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob is still flying the W here in the Allstate Showcase studio, because we're going to be flying that W tonight. I'm very confident of that. As always, you can find all of our past shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcasts. Just go to iTunes and search for my name, Rick Pearson. We've got a great show coming up today after Dave's 7:30 news update. We'll speak to a good and longtime friend of the program, Amanda Vinicky. Amanda's the State House correspondent for Illinois Public Radio and WUIS-FM in Springfield. And we'll talk about last week's controversial U.S. Senate debate in Springfield and about some of those contentious legislative races. Dave will be back with more news at 8 o'clock, and then we'll speak with Kent Redfield. Kent is Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. We'll talk to him about all of the money that is being poured into these legislative races. And then after the 8:30 news update, we'll be joined by Tanya Trish. She's the Vice President and General Counsel of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. We'll talk to her about the group's opposition to the soda tax that has been proposed by Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. That's all coming up, but first we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue on this getting over the sogginess of those overnight rains that we've had. Kind of a cool day today, cloudy day, mid-50s forecast, but supposed to be warmer as we start up the week. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and boy, it's been an interesting last couple of days. FBI Director James Comey indicating that the FBI is taking another look at the Hillary Clinton email investigation, and then we learn it's not necessarily about Clinton and her private email server, but about devices used by disgraced former Congressman Anthony Weiner and his estranged wife, Uma Abedin, a top aide to Hillary Clinton. I suppose perhaps in this very strange presidential election year, it's only appropriate that some people are going to base their decision in part due to a federal investigation of a man named Weiner and his texts to a 15-year-old girl. Well, here's how Hillary Clinton responded to FBI Director James Comey's letter to Congress and how she's trying to spin her campaign forward.
We are 11 days out from perhaps the most important national election of our lifetimes. Voting is already underway in our country. So the American people deserve to get the full and complete facts immediately. The director himself has said he doesn't know whether the emails referenced in his letter are significant or not. I'm confident whatever they are will not change the conclusion reached in July. Therefore, it's imperative that the Bureau explain this issue in question, whatever it is, without any delay. So I look forward to moving forward to focus on the important challenges facing the American people, winning on November 8th, and working with all Americans to build a better future for our country. Thank you.
Now the pressure is building on FBI Director Comey to come up with a bit more detail on exactly what it is that he's talking about when it comes to emails, what it has to do with the Clinton investigation. But already we're seeing the race tightening as we get closer to Election Day. The latest ABC News Washington Post tracking poll results that are in this morning show the race stands nationally at 46% for Hillary Clinton, 45% for Donald Trump. We're looking at that. That's in a four-way trial heat. In a one-on-one, it's plus +3 Clinton over Trump. Still not a significant difference. Obviously, those numbers point down to the issue of what turnout is going to be like. And, of course, that remains the great unknown, as it always does at election time, but even more so now that we have the FBI controversy now renewed and swirling as we get closer to Election Day. Of course, all of this going on is the campaign entering the final stretch, and Clinton is up heavy on the airwaves in the swing states, including with this ad that focuses on the family.
Far too many families today don't earn what they need and don't have the opportunities they deserve. I believe families deserve quality education for their kids, child care they can trust and afford, equal pay for women, and jobs they can really live on. People ask me, what'll be different if I'm president? Well, kids and families have been the passion of my life, and they will be the heart of my presidency.
Now, Clinton is also using another ad, this one narrated by Morgan Freeman, to show contrast between herself and Donald Trump.
Our children, they look up to us. What we value, how we treat others. And now they're looking to see what kind of leaders we choose, who we'll entrust our country and their future to. Will it be the one respected around the world, or the one who frightens our allies and emboldens our enemies? The one with a deep understanding of the challenges we face, or the one who is unprepared for them? A steady hand or a loose cannon? Common sense and unity, or drama and division? A woman who spent her life helping children and families, or a man who spent his life helping himself? Our children are looking to us. What example will we set? What kind of country will we be? Hillary Clinton, because we're stronger together.
Now, of course, as we were all watching the opening night of the World Series last week, there was this interesting give and take between Fox News host Megyn Kelly and former House Speaker and Trump defender Newt Gingrich.
As a media story, we don't get to say the 10 women are lying. Oh. We have to cover that story, sir.
Oh, sure. Okay, so it's worth 23 minutes of the three networks to cover that story. And Hillary Clinton in a secret speech in Brazil to a bank that pays her $225,000, saying her dream is an open border where 600 million people could come to America. That's not worth covering.
That is worth covering.
You want to go back through the tapes of your show recently? You are fascinated with sex, and you don't care about public policy.
Me?
Now, that's
really?
What I get out of watching you tonight.
You know what, Mr. Speaker? I'm not fascinated by sex, but I am fascinated by the protection of women. And understanding what we're getting in the Oval Office. And I think the American voters would like to know.
And therefore, we're going to send Bill Clinton back to the East Wing because, after all, you are worried about sexual predators.
Yeah, listen, it's not about me. It's about the women and men of America. And the poll numbers show us that the women of America in particular are very concerned about these allegations and in large part believe that they are a real issue. And
do you want to comment on whether the Clinton ticket has a relationship to a sexual predator?
We on the Kelly file have covered that story as well, sir. I will tell you the polls.
I want to hear you use the words. I want to hear your words. Bill Clinton, sexual predator. I dare you. Say Bill Clinton, sexual predator.
Mr. Speaker,
disbarred by the Arkansas bar. Disbarred by the Arkansas bar. $850,000 penalty.
Excuse me, sir. We on the Kelly file have covered the Clinton matter as well. We've hosted Kathleen Willey. We've covered the examples of him being accused as well, but he's not on the ticket. And the polls also show that
they'll
the American public is less interested in the deeds of Hillary Clinton's husband than they are in the deeds of the man who asks us to make him president, Donald Trump. We're going to have to leave it at that, and you can take your anger issues and spend some time working on them, Mr. Speaker. Thanks for being
here. And you too.
A very, very interesting give and take there on by Megyn Kelly and former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. My friends at the website 538, the website founded by Nate Silver, the statistician who has done very good in his forecasts of electoral politics. And Sam, you might find this interesting, that 538, now owned by ESPN, they are out this morning saying the Cubs have a smaller chance of winning than Trump does.
Wait, why would I enjoy that?
No, I thought you would find it interesting.
Oh.
I didn't say you would enjoy it.
Okay.
I thought you would find it interesting.
That is interesting. What are the numbers?
They're rating the Cubs' total chance of winning the series at a measly 15%.
Yikes.
So, yeah.
And but, Trump's got to be in the 40s, right?
They have various election forecast models, and Trump is at 18.9%.
He's only at 18.9?
Yes.
Wow.
Now, of course, those numbers will probably be updated later today, reflecting these latest polls, like the ABC News Washington Post tracking poll. But
yeah, how many of those numbers are going to go to the polls?
Exactly.
Do the calculators vote?
No. I think the calculators are taking a walk on this election, actually.
I agree.
No kidding. But hey, you know, I'd take the odds at 15%. What the heck? Well, Trump has been campaigning heavily, trying to reverse those trends that had shown him down in the polls, and concerns among down-ballot Republicans as well. In North Carolina, Trump told an African-American audience he would never let them down.
Our opponent represents the rigged system and the failed thinking of yesterday. Hillary Clinton's campaign offers only the depressing pessimism that says this is as good as it gets, and it's never going to get better. She's been doing this for 30 years, and for 30 years it's only gotten worse. American politics is caught in a time loop. We keep electing the same people over and over and over.
That's Donald Trump in North Carolina. Meanwhile, Clinton campaigning heavily along with a variety of surrogates. She used Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren to respond to Trump having called Clinton a, quote, nasty woman, unquote, during that last presidential debate.
Get this, Donald. Nasty women are tough. Nasty women are smart. And nasty women vote. And on November 8th, we nasty women are going to march our nasty feet to cast our nasty votes to get you out of our lives forever.
That's Elizabeth Warren campaigning for Hillary Clinton. Well, joining me now on the phone is my good friend Amanda Vinicky. She's the State House correspondent for Illinois Public Radio and WUIS-FM in Springfield, and the unofficial fill-in for me when I on those occasional times when I need to take a breather from all of this. Amanda, thanks so much for getting up with me.
Rick, good morning.
Yes, rare occasions. Well, I will tell you, when I got up this morning and was listening to the rainfall and a little bit of thunder, it was one of those where I really didn't want to, especially after the Cubs loss last night. That was kind of...
Yeah. I imagine a lot of people want to sleep in and make that last night go away.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. But we got a good Sunday night to look forward to. I'm very confident of that.
There we go.
I wanted to have you on because, one, I know you were at this U.S. Senate debate in Springfield last week featuring Republican, first-term Republican Senator Mark Kirk and Democratic challenger, two-term Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth. And it's kind of interesting that, you know, even yesterday there's still fallout over his remark that questioned her family's heritage and its military legacy. Two groups that had endorsed Kirk, two groups that Kirk had kind of used to showcase himself as a social moderate on the issues of gay rights as well as gun control, both of those groups yanking their endorsement. And, I mean...
Yeah, the Human Rights Committee and Americans for Responsible Solutions, that's that Gabby Giffords anti-gun pack, both pulling their endorsements.
And, of course, we should say that the Human Rights Campaign had come under fire when they first endorsed Kirk, which I think occurred all the way back in March. And, you know, Tammy Duckworth saying, well, you know, you have these groups that will side with the incumbent as far as endorsements go, and kind of saying that's the politics of that. But now in light of the yanking of these endorsements, and, of course, Gabby Giffords was the Democratic congresswoman who was severely wounded in an assassination attempt, a Democrat, you have the Kirk campaign responding that yanking these endorsements, well, that's just politics.
Politics of going with who looks like it'll be the winner. So these groups trying to get on Duckworth's good side, perhaps is maybe part of that. But also, I think, I mean, just this backlash was immediate and severe. And I think what was striking and part about it is really how long it took for a true apology to come from Kirk, a, you know, major public one. Wasn't until the next morning on Twitter, and that's the sort of thing that during the actual campaign, you had Kirk's aides coming up to him during commercial breaks, and maybe it would have been a good time right then to say, hey, you know, I was trying to be more aggressive, or whatever he was going to say. I'm not sure that it would have done anything, but that's, I think, part of why we continue to see this. Part of it is that Duckworth, again, is up in the polls already, and I think that really it was just a stunning comment. You've had Kirk really say that he is tried to present himself as somebody who could be appealing to Democrats, and yet that has instead, I think, angered a lot of the Republican conservative base. Democrats aren't looking for anywhere to go. They have somebody in Duckworth they don't need to vote for. And then I think it truly is a lot of people, you know, questioning, hey, is this just that Kirk has lost his filter and perhaps lingering effects of his 2012 stroke although the Kirk campaign has said that he is full cognitive recovery and has issued a doctor's note to that effect.
And Kirk himself denies that there's no losing of his filter or whatever. But, you know, what I found interesting is that, you know, in that debate, you know, he pointedly noted the fact that he had unendorsed Donald Trump in particular because of Trump's comments about how he questioned the fairness of an Indiana-born federal judge of Mexican heritage that was overseeing the Trump University case. And Kirk said that was the point that he said no. But then he brings up this question of, Tammy Duckworth's heritage as being born in Thailand and how, you know, her relatives from Thailand fought with George Washington.
He was trying to leave behind Trump and present himself as somebody who found that racism very offensive, and then made a remark that you have a lot of people calling very offensive, and some have also characterized as racist. I thought I'll add kind of an interesting take from actually Mike Pesca, who used to be a public radio reporter, but saying, you know, be careful there in that if Kirk hadn't remembered that, in fact, Duckworth had this family history dating back to the American Revolution, then it wasn't a racist comment. It was just a wrong one. You can't be one or both. I don't know. Something to kind of think about there. I basically saying, quote, in this case, if it's ignorant, it can't be racist. But if it was racist, then that is, of course, ignorant. So point being, I mean, I think that you already had Kirk thrilling, and this has sealed the deal. There's, of course, this debate coming up on Friday, but I we'll all be watching and waiting. I've heard some people say, wow, can you even fathom Kirk getting back up there and doing this? He's in it to win it. I do presume that he will get back up on that debate stage, just given that would be such a big story, and that he's, you know, committed to winning this. But I think no matter what, this campaign has really rallied the troops. Immediately after you said it, you had not only all these comments from Democratic operatives, but of course you had it as part of a fundraising campaign by Tammy Duckworth too.
Never miss an opportunity for fundraising. Never.
Never.
We're speaking with Amanda Vinicky. She's the State House correspondent for Illinois Public Radio and WUIS-FM in Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Joining me on the phone is Amanda Vinicky, State House correspondent for Illinois Public Radio and WUIS-FM Springfield. Why do I always have trouble with that, Amanda? I don't
get it. A lot of people do. In fact, we often now go by NPR Illinois.
Okay.
It's easier. So if you want to make your...
All right. You know what? I will.
Go for that.
I absolutely will. We're talking about the debate last week with U.S. Senator Mark Kirk and Democratic challenger Tammy Duckworth. And what I thought was kind of interesting, you mentioned about the delay of kind of the... Kirk apologizing, but when he did so, he does it on Twitter. That's our new form of communications?
I do think that is sort of the way of the world. It's a way to get it out there in public. It's maybe less gauche than a press release or something to that effect. You can have retweets galore. I think part of that, however, if you read some of the comments, on his apology and on Tammy Duckworth herself, I would say that some of the commenters that are upset about Kirk's offensive comment, let's just say that they fully embrace offensive, if you want to go there. But it is a way that it gets attention of the media. It's out there in public, so you don't have any of the going back to the last gubernatorial election when you had Rauner say, well, I called the legislative leaders, and they say, no, he didn't. It's all out there. It's public. So perhaps that's the tactic. And, you know, you also saw Tammy Duckworth respond on Twitter, too. It is definitely to me, Twitter is kind of one of the changers of this election, obviously, this race. And you look at how Trump has employed that to great effect.
Well, and Tammy Duckworth, as you said, did accept the apology via Twitter, although I found it interesting that she waited about 5 hours to do that.
Exactly. About 11 a.m. The other one was just, well, I would presume many people were about ready to pack up their offices on a beautiful Friday evening.
And perhaps letting
letting it fester. So.
Yes, exactly. letting it sink in for those who hadn't heard about it. I want to ask you, too, about, and we're going to talk to Kent Redfield coming up from the University of Illinois at Springfield, but just this influx of money, and I think it was Pat Brady, who the former state Republican chairman, who said that perhaps the most viewed person on television these days in the state of Illinois is House Speaker Michael Madigan.
Michael Madigan, and it's not smiley, happy photos of Madigan in those campaign ads where he's, you know, like out with kids and puppies and sunshine.
Now, no offense to the speaker, but I don't remember ever seeing a picture with him with a puppy, you know.
I don't either, but that'd be great. And maybe, come on, I'm sure that somebody can somehow work that into a campaign brochure. We could get that happening.
Why not? Everything else is being photoshopped into those things.
Right? Oh, I think my favorite ad was that Madigan morphed into both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, trying to basically bring in anybody that voters seem not to be very happy with these days and put it all into one bizarre-looking human being. That was maybe my favorite.
I mean, certainly, and Pat Brady tried this when he was chairman, of trying to kind of demonize Madigan.
Mm-hmm.
But with the influx of money from Governor Rauner and his allies, and the fact that virtually every one of the contested campaigns for both the House and the Senate Republicans are linking the Democratic candidate to Madigan, I think you have to wonder if it isn't having some noticeable effect.
You know, I am not privy to their internal polling, but you got to figure that if that, I think also in part, much of this money, of course, is coming from Governor Bruce Rauner, whose distaste for Madigan is, I think, very deep. And true, he believes that Madigan is the root of many of Illinois' wrongs. And so in part, you would have campaigns, you know, using anything for effect that they think will work. And you've seen, I think, on both sides, a lot of stretched claims. But this is one where clearly they're getting direction from on high. It's a strategy that Rauner has, although he's backed away from saying the word Madigan right now during the campaign. I'm guessing it'll pop up again in a negative fashion from the governor's mouth. And so maybe that's part of it. I think they figure that if you pound on this message for what has now been several years, Pat Brady got things going with the Fire Madigan campaign. And it was true, but it was also almost jovial. I remember, could go on to Cafe Press and they had all sorts of sayings set up and there was something quippy and witty that you could get so your dog could wear an anti-Madigan outfit and a Fire Madigan. But it has moved on from that to trying to take this extra step, of course, of not just Madigan, but why that matters if you vote for a Democrat. And there is truth to that, particularly not so much in these ones where you are tying Senate candidates, but by and large, you have had Democratic candidates vote for Speaker Madigan when it is no longer up to the voters, when it becomes your elected representative's time to choose who their leadership will be. So that's one where I guess the Republican Party isn't stretching. How well that'll work, like I said, you got to presume it's going somewhere because they sure aren't letting up.
They aren't letting up, and the money is just unbelievable.
Oh my gosh.
Well, and here in the Chicago area, the race between Republican Representative Mike McAuliffe and Democratic challenger Mary Martwig on the northwest side of Chicago. Remember, this is one of the 118 seats in the Illinois House of Representatives, and the money in that race has now eclipsed the $4 million mark for one single House seat. We're going to take a quick break. Thank you, Amanda Vinicky, from State House correspondent from Illinois Public Radio and WUISFM Springfield. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning, and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin for this October 30th, 2016. My good friends at the Literacy Volunteers of Illinois, it's time once again for their 13th annual Scrabble for Literacy Challenge. And that'll be held on next Sunday, November 6th, and that's at Grossinger Honda at 6600 Northwestern Avenue. It's a kind of a fun thing. There's prizes. There's just for fun games. There's where you can play by any rules that you want. That's normally the way I play when I get there. And there's also a professional Scrabble tournament that's for rated Scrabble players. So I'd encourage you to go out there, and it all starts at 1 o'clock next Sunday. And that's the Scrabble for Literacy Challenge that benefits the Literacy Volunteers of Illinois. You can find out more information about that, and you can also register. You can go to lvillinois.org for more information on that. Last week, late night host Jimmy Kimmel, he hosted President Obama on his show. And one of the more interesting things that Kimmel does is this kind of shtick called mean tweets, where he has people read mean tweets about themselves. Well, he asked President Obama to read some mean tweets about President Obama.
Barack Obama dances like how his jeans look. You know, this jeans thing, this is so old. This was years ago. Come on. My mom bought new conditioner, and it sucks. It isn't even conditioning my hair. I blame Obama. Barack Obama. Bro, do you even lift? Well, I lifted the ban on Cuban cigars. That's worth something. Barack Obama is the Barack Obama is the Sharknado of presidents. Loud, stupid, and overhyped. Hashtag Sharknado 4. President Obama will go down as perhaps the worst president in the history of the United States! Exclamation point. At real Donald Trump. Well, at real Donald Trump, at least I will go down as a president.
That's mean tweets from President Obama on the Jimmy Kimmel show last week. Well, joining me now on the program by phone is Kent Redfield. Kent's a good friend of mine, and he's emeritus professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield and a specialist on the issue of campaign finance in Illinois. Kent, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Oh, good to be here.
As I was speaking to Amanda Vinicky in the last segment of the show, just the amazing amount of money that's being poured into these legislative campaigns. And as I also said, Pat Brady, I think the former state Republican chairman, said that perhaps the most viewed TV personality in Illinois right now has to be Michael J. Madigan.
Certainly, yeah. We're running these hyper-expensive races really throughout the state, and the Republican theme is it's all Madigan's fault, and if you're voting for a Democrat, you're voting for Speaker Madigan. So we have pretty much unlimited money certainly on the Republican side. The Democrats are matching it. We're going to spend easily $50-60 million on legislative races, twice what we spent 2 years ago.
You know, I remember back in, it was the mid-80s, and it was one of the first stories I wrote for the Chicago Tribune, and it was about the Illinois State Senate race up in Rockford, which had exceeded $300,000.
Yeah, that just seems almost quaint. I mean, 2 years ago, we had a $2.3 million House race down in southern Illinois, and right now, you know, we probably are going to have at least 10 House races that are going to break that record. And, you know, four $3 million House races, four $4 million House races. The Senate will easily have three $4 million House races, or Senate races, break the old record. Could be even, you know, even more. So it's just... And if you live in one of these districts, then it's constant TV. It's constant direct mail pieces. I mean, it is, you know, we think we're lucky because we're not getting the presidential election. But if you're living in one of these legislative districts that's targeted, you don't miss the presidential election at all. You're really getting hammered.
And it's and you don't want to go out to the mailbox because there's seven mail pieces a day. You don't want to pick up the phone because that's going to be the robocalls, and you don't want to watch the TV.
No, it's just, you know, we're getting, you know, we're getting a comptroller's race that's going to be a $9 million race. That'll be probably be three times what we've ever spent on a comptroller's race. And so it's the only game in town, but it just is, you know, shows you how much money is flowing around. I mean, and a lot of it is, you know, $60 million is coming basically from Bruce Rauner and then Ken Griffin, you know, the richest man in Illinois, and Richard Euland. Those three individuals are have funded about $60 million in you know, since January of 2015, and certainly, you know, 4 years ago, big labor in that $117 million House, you know, governor's race that we had, you know, big labor was, you know, spent about $32 million on you know, statewide and legislative elections, and they're certainly going to spend at least that much this time around. So we really are awash with money.
We're speaking with Kent Redfield, Emeritus Professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue in downtown Chicago. And joining me on the phone is Kent Redfield, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield, an expert on Illinois campaign finance. We're talking about the torrent of money in Illinois' political races. And as Kent said, you don't need to have necessarily a competitive presidential race in Illinois if you're living in one of these contested Illinois House or Illinois Senate districts. But Kent, you kind of before the break touched on the point about the donors, and when you look at the donors to Republican Comptroller Leslie Munger, who's being challenged by Democrat Chicago City Clerk Susana Mendoza, and this is through October 22nd, but all the money in that race, Munger has raised $8.6 million from the start of the year to October 22nd. And of that $8.6 million, there are just a few sources. Ken Griffin, $5 million. Richard Uihlein, $2 million. Citizens for Rauner, the governor's campaign fund, $1 million. $120,000 from the Illinois Republican Party, and $260,000, that's a loan from her husband. So all other sources out of $8.6 million is $267,000.
Well, and that, you know, we do have contribution limits in Illinois, but the reality is when you get a contested race, you're almost always going to have independent expenditures or self-funding, which happened in this case. And so, you know, a $260,000 loan, family loan from the candidate's husband took the caps off. And then, you know, not you have this money coming in from really the same three people or the same sources that are funding the Republican side in the legislative races. Now, $3 million of that then got transferred to the state Republican Party or to Representative Duncan, who's or Durkin, rather, who's the leader of the House Republicans. So you're moving money into that campaign, and then you're moving it into legislative races. The Democrats on the other side have to deal in smaller numbers because generally they're dealing with caps, and so they've aggregated a lot of contributions from labor unions to go to different political committees. Now, in a lot of House races and Senate races, including the race where the Republican leader, Representative Durkin, doesn't have an opponent, we've had independent expenditures that have made the caps come off. And so, you've got these huge amounts of money that are coming in, basically unlimited. And then, all of these races start to look like, Speaker Madigan versus Governor Rauner, rather than a contest over who's representing a district in Southern Illinois.
Well, and there's always that question about saturation, and we'll get to that in a moment. But when you ask the Republicans about taking these huge contributions, primarily being supplied by the governor's office, by the governor himself. I'm sorry, not the governor's office, but the governor's campaign political fund. But they say, well, that's just to counter all of the money that the Democrats have routinely gotten from labor unions and trial attorneys, their usual sources. That this is an equalizer.
Well, there's, in some sense, there is parity. This is more parity. In fact, in some cases, the Republicans are outspending the Democrats. Historically, the Democrats have had an advantage in terms of money. But, again, if I'm sitting in a Southern Illinois district, I'm represented by a Democrat, and I'm looking at a campaign that says, you're being represented by a wholly owned subsidiary of the speaker, why don't you make a change and elect a representative who's a wholly owned subsidiary of the governor? I don't know that does much for the democratic process or for feelings among citizens that the political system is about them and their local issues. So, I think this amount of money being concentrated on both sides, has some really unfortunate impacts, both on making policy, because then it becomes a gridlock when you get to Springfield, and we certainly should not treat John Cullerton, the Senate Democratic president, as kind of the third wheel in terms of this. The Democrats control two chambers, and those two caucuses are quite independent from each other.
Is there a point where is there a saturation point, and have we hit that, do you think?
Oh, I think that's certainly the case. We're starting, if you think of a House district, in the primary in the spring, the fifth House district, Representative Duncan, $5 million on a primary race. This more money was spent in that race with about 100,000, 110,000 people than was spent countywide in Cook County in a three-way Democratic race for the state's attorney's the state's attorney's office, which was, three million people in Cook County, $5 million, 110 million people in that one House district, $5 million. I mean, that's crazy. You just can't consume that much television, that many mailers. It doesn't speak to local representation and local control.
That's Kent Redfield. He's emeritus professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield, my good friend. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Oh, certainly. Anytime.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. The folks at the Chicago Board of Elections asked that I remind you that early voting going on today, and that Sundays are the best days to go and cast an early vote if you want to go ahead and take care of those duties. And early voting sites in Chicago, there's 51 of them. They're open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sunday, October 30th, as well as Sunday, November 6th. So if you want to go cast an early vote, but you're afraid about lines or something, they say Sunday is the time to do it. Earlier in the program, I was discussing with Amanda Vinicky the U.S. Senate debate between Republican Senator Mark Kirk and Democratic challenger, two-term Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth, and about some of the this controversial remark that has resulted in a gay rights group as well as a gun violence prevention group withdrawing their support for Mark Kirk. I thought I would play a clip of that so you could hear exactly how this came about during that Senate debate.
You know, my family has served this nation in uniform going back to the Revolution. I'm a daughter of the American Revolution. I've bled for this nation. But I still want to be there in the Senate when the drums of war sound, because people are quick to sound the drums of war. And I want to be there to say, this is what it costs. This is what you're asking us to do. And if that's the case, I'll go. Families like mine are the ones that bleed first. But let's make sure the American people understand what we are engaging in. And let's hold our allies accountable, because we can't do it all.
Senator Kirk, 30 seconds to rebut.
I had forgotten that your parents came all the way from Thailand to serve George Washington.
Move on to the next question. This is Bernie Schoenberg.
You heard the dead silence there. Well, Kirk apologized a day later, and Duckworth took a few hours to accept it. And now the two of them have their third and final debate on Friday evening at Channel 7. And, of course, that's Friday night, and it comes right before Election Day. Well, joining me now in the Allstate Showcase studios, Tanya Trish. She's the vice president and general counsel of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. And, Tanya, a lot of work ahead of you, as we have Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, who's proposed this sugar-sweetened soda tax.
Well, sure. First of all, thanks for having me on the program. But let me clarify a few things. This is actually a proposed tax on lots of beverages that actually don't have any sugar in them. A lot of people have been thinking, well, you know what? I don't drink pop, so this isn't going to affect me. This affects over 9,000 products that are being sold in the county today, products that have sugar in them, products that have artificial sweeteners in them as well. All of them will be taxed the same. And so I just wanted to make sure that the listeners understood how vast the category of products is that are going to be taxed, possibly, and then what the cost of that's going to be.
And I know, you know, people argue, oh, well, this is for health. But at the same time, it's about revenue. And it's kind of like the red light cameras were supposed to be about safety, and it was about revenue. But when you're talking about, and what's the differentiation here of what products get taxed and what don't get taxed?
Right. So just to pick up on your point about it's about health, well, you know, the county approved over $130 million in pay raises for county employees, and they didn't have a way to pay for them. And so herein comes the sweetened beverage tax. So again, this is supposedly about health, but we all know that it's about filling a budget hole. And more importantly, if it was about health, then why are products that don't have any sugar in them at all being taxed? Why are people who have made a decision to not drink a full calorie beverage being taxed at the same rate as someone who has made the decision to drink that full calorie beverage? So it's not really about health. It's about how do we make enough money to fill this budget hole and to carry us through the next few years. That being said, you know, I think everyone should be put on notice. This is a way to fill a budget hole by sort of looking in your grocery cart and figuring out new things to tax. Although a couple cities have done it already, this is a really new way to look at budget holes. And so today it's beverages that have sugar in them or beverages that have artificial sweeteners in them. Tomorrow it could be salt The next day, you could be fat.
Twinkies.
Right. You know what I mean? There are a number of things that, that people eat and drink that are not the best for you in large quantities. But, you know, to sort of settle in on beverages that have sugar or artificial sweetened or that are artificial sweetened, we think is should be a concern for any consumer.
So when we look at this, and I kind of phrased this earlier, but what beverage is taxed, what beverage is not taxed?
So a full calorie beverage, so you can say a soda that has sugar in it, you can say an iced tea that may have some sugar in it, or any beverage that has an artificial sweetener. So it's anything from a product that you get from the grocery store and products that you get from your local coffee shop that have sugar in them. So think about your Frappuccinos and all of the other sort of non-grocery store products that people like to enjoy every day.
How does, obviously this tax isn't imposed yet, but I can imagine we're back to the issue of trying to program cash registers and actually figure out what is taxable and what isn't.
It's going to be a very difficult task if this tax passes for grocers, because I might get into the weeds here, but the mechanics of actually figuring out how to tax the products they sell is very complicated. And so when you're talking about a tax like this, where it's on potentially 9,000 different products, it's very difficult for the systems to understand what to tax at what rate. Because remember, it's not a set tax. It's not a 10.25% tax on it, right? It depends on how many ounces
it's
are in that
product.
It's a
penny an ounce.
So it's going to vary by product and vary by size. And so that's going to be very difficult for the computer systems to understand. And when you think about, you know, your independent grocers who don't have as sophisticated systems as some of your national chains, it's going to be a very large uphill battle to climb. And let me also say that, you know, when you're talking about a tax like this, and you're talking about it solely in Cook County, you think about all of those grocers that are on the border, right, on the Cook County side of the border, and all of the folks who are on the other side of the border who do not have to pay that tax. So it really hurts the grocers who decided to locate on this side of the border, decided to pay the property taxes here, employ people here, pay those employment taxes, all those investments that they make. And you put all of that in jeopardy when you make Cook County different and more expensive than another place. And, you know, someone might say, well, I'm not going to skip the county line because, you know, to buy my iced tea. And that might be true. But when you think about a sugar sweetened beverage tax on top of the high gas tax, on top of the high sales tax in Chicago, there's the highest sales tax in the country. It starts to add up, and you start to say, you know what, it's probably just less expensive for me to travel those extra couple miles to go to Will or go to Lake or go to DuPage and do all of my shopping there.
Which
just makes sense.
Which you're seeing in some cases right now.
Oh my gosh. So, you know, it's very interesting because the advocates have pointed to the fact that, you know, there are lots of taxes everywhere, right? And that people will just decide to drink less or just pay for their beverages here. And we have seen that taxes run people absolutely outside of the city of Chicago, and they run them outside of the county.
We're speaking with Tonya Trish. She's the Vice President and General Counsel for the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, and joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Tonya Trish. She's the Vice President and General Counsel of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. We're talking about Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle's proposed penny an ounce tax on soda. And we've gotten questions on about, you know, is it just sugar? And no, it's not. It would also be applied to artificially sweetened drinks. It's not just carbonated drinks. It's as you said, 9,000 different products. But an interesting factor is, and we had a Tribune story about this, is that in other states, some other states or communities where they do this, it's more on the distributor It's not like a direct sales tax. And so there are different rules when that applies.
Right. So there are only two cities that have a sweetened beverage tax. That's Berkeley, California, and Philadelphia just passed one. And I don't believe that theirs has actually gone into effect yet, but it soon will. And so the tax that's being proposed would be on the consumer, but the distributor would collect it. So the retailer would pay the tax up front when the product comes in the back door.
And adjust their price.
Exactly, to the consumer. But I would note that let's kick it back to the policy of it, you know, why this is supposed to be a good policy. Our SNAP customers, who we value.
SNAP is...
SNAP is the old food stamp program. They don't actually pay tax. Federal government doesn't allow you to charge the tax on any of the purchases that are made with SNAP dollars. So if they're buying sweetened beverages with those dollars, we just lose the tax on that we've already paid the retailer. And so when you think about the policy that's supposed to be encouraging people to drink less of these products, well, you're not encouraging that population to do that. And that population is usually a population that has less access to health care, less access to nutrition education. And so, you know, what is a policy if everyone's not included? And also, just on the revenue portion of it, we not only have SNAP customers, but we have other nonprofits who buy lots of things from us every day. We value those customers too, but they don't pay tax. And so, again, we'll eat this tax because we can't collect it back from the distributor. And so while it's supposed to be a tax on the consumer, and in part it is, it also is a tax on the retailer. And I would remind you that we've sort of been through a lot in this past month with the county when you're talking about the starting wage increase and the sick leave. And so this is another thing. If it passes, it would go into effect July 1, 2017, the same day that the wage and the sick leave would go into effect. So retailers are really having a difficult time.
I want to talk to you about that issue of the minimum wage increase. And actually, we've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yeah, good morning, Rick. And actually, boy, you hit on just what I wanted to call about. I just think in this economy right now that the retailers are really carrying an undue burden. You know, 40 years ago, I started working, you know, as a bagger, but it was an entry-level position, and I moved on. I hear people justify the increase of the minimum wage and some of these other things, the sick time, and they say, well, people that are working there are raising families. But I think that speaks more to a larger problem, that this economy is not providing, you know, jobs for people. Also, it's almost an over-reliance on retail. And last, I just think that retail, as it was so for so many years for high school students and, you know, people like that who just wanted a part-time job and really to get started. But I wanted to get you, maybe you can just comment on that. I really think it's pretty much an undue burden on the retailers at this point. So thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Ron.
Sure. So, I mean, I think you hit it right on the head. You know, obviously, we have a large part-time workforce, and that's for a lot of different reasons. You know, a lot of the folks who work for us either have other jobs, or they're going to school, or, you know, they need the flexibility that retail offers them. And so, you know, these jobs were never meant to be sort of full-time positions to raise families on. They are ways to sort of supplement income while you're doing other things. And they're ways to sort of get a start, get some sort of basic skill sets with how to deal with people in the public, and then move up within our organization or move on. And I think a lot of that gets lost in this conversation about people sort of raising families on these jobs. That's not what these jobs are for. And more importantly, you're talking about a starting wage, a place where people start. It's the floor. It's not the ceiling. So where you go is really up to you. And so I think we need to keep that in mind. Further, I would say that this has really been a bit of an experiment. You know, we've had experience with increasing the starting wage for many years now, but it has never been this high, this fast. We're talking about in Cook County, and they've modeled what they're doing off of the city of Chicago. Right. We're talking about a very large increase at the beginning, going from $8.25 to $10 on July 1, and then going up a dollar every year until they get to $13 in 2020. And so the minimum wage, the starting wage, has never increased that large that quickly. And so all of the economists will tell you they don't know what's going to happen. You know, we've seen what's going on in San Francisco and Seattle, where they also have pretty large increases fairly quickly. But those economies are very different from the city of Chicago and from Cook County. And I think that's important to note. When your economy relies so heavily on the tech sector, you know, the tech sector, for every one job that the tech sector creates, it creates four other jobs. Chicago and Cook County's economies are much more diverse. And so we don't have that sector to live or die on. And so how it's going to affect San Francisco is not dispositive of how it's going to affect Chicago and Cook County. And so, you know, when I say it's an experiment, it's not only an experiment to see what will happen, but you've got small businesses out here who see these elected officials experimenting with their livelihoods. They're the ones, you know, most of the businesses out here are small businesses. They're the ones who are projecting and forecasting and creating opportunities for people to work. And they're out here saying, we don't know how we're going to handle this. We don't know how we're going to get to 13, because you're also talking about wage compression. You're not just talking about starting wages. You're talking about all the other people who've been there, who've been with them for years, who are making more than that. You're going to need to increase their salaries as well. And so it's not just increasing those who are starting with you. It's increasing them all over the board. And that's a very significant expense for a small retailer, a small business owner to have.
It seems like we're living through experimental times. Mm-hmm. Tonya Trish, Vice President and General Counsel of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, thank you as always.
Appreciate it.